Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by David Jones. His official title is the Executive Director of High Tech Inventor Alliance, HTIA, which is a patent policy advocacy group representing some of the biggest tech companies in the world. But he just might be one of the most effective advocates when it comes to patent policy in DC. So first of all, thank you for joining.
Thank you for having me. It's good to see you.
It just happens to be that you're the first person I'm interviewing in person post-pandemic. And the last person who I've interviewed in the same room in my office was Josh Malone.
Well, it's fitting then. I think you have both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and you, another thing that you have in common is whenever I talk to staffers from Capitol Hill, two names come up, Josh Malone and David Jones. And I think the way you guys operate, I don't know if you'll find it fair, but you try to keep a low profile and Josh has a different approach. So that kind of speaks to the reach you have on Capitol Hill, even though you're...
I actually think it probably speaks more to my lack of impulse control. Apparently I say memorable things in meetings. I was in a meeting yesterday with a member of Congress and said something as a joke, and my member's face is just kind of blanched.
Can you tell us the member of Congress?
I should probably leave that out for now. And I probably shouldn't have said that at all, because now my members will listen to this and be reminded of my terrible behavior. But no, apparently for whatever reason, I'm memorable on the Hill. So
last time we spoke and I interviewed in written form was, you started HTIA as executive director in 2018. We spoke, I think, in 2019. At that time, it seemed the pendulum, as we discussed, was swinging back towards a more pro-patent direction. And you kind of, big tech companies were in a defensive posture, I think it's fair to say, at that point. I think the latter hasn't really changed. But since you've been at HTIA, it seems like it's been a victory, 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 and just the three that kind of stick to mind: the Section 101 reform never happened, the PTAB, the efforts to restrain PTAB by the previous administration have been kind of undone, and then the third victory that I can think of is a lot of big tech companies were unhappy about Judge Albright getting all the patent cases, and that changed as well.
He wasn't getting all the patent cases, just like a quarter to a third of the patent cases.
What happened since we last spoke? And is that an accurate assessment that you've been on a winning streak?
I don't know that that's the case. I mean, honestly, there's a lot of what Director Iancu did on the PTAB that's still there. And I should also say, despite the implication here, these victories I don't think have a whole lot to do with me. I've got great members, but beyond that, there are a lot of really active people, Josh at CCIA and Abby
members,
at Engine.
And by members, you mean members of HTIA and
members of HTIA. They're also good members of Congress, although...
But you don't have them, right? That's them.
I'm getting to be an old man. I actually used to know a number of members of Congress, and as slowly as I get older, they die off or retire. So, Senator Leahy is one of the last ones that that I worked with closely when I was on the Hill. But I think I think here last time I think I agreed with the pendulum kind of analogy because that's how it felt. I think. Honestly, this time, it doesn't feel like a pendulum swing, really. It feels more fractured than that to me. So I think there are a lot of real question marks out there. Like I said, a lot of the stuff that Director Iancu did I like him a lot, but I dislike some of his policies rather intensely. So some of the things that we were pretty unhappy with are still there. Discretionary denials they've dropped substantially, but they haven't gone away. And you still, on the FinTIF side, you still have to deal with stipulations, which, there are mixed views in the tech community about the stipulations and how much of a win it's been. So I think rather than a pendulum swing, I guess I'd probably characterize it as kind of a moderation. And maybe that is a pendulum swing. Maybe that's a distinction without a difference. But it certainly doesn't feel to me like, you know, I appreciate you saying we've had a winning streak. it doesn't quite feel that way to me. It feels to me like we've kind of clawed our way back to, you know, approaching neutral. And then looking at, especially on the Senate side, looking at the what's likely to happen, I think we're in for probably a couple of rough years at least.
So before we talk about all that, I want to talk about how kind of you ended up doing what you're doing. You worked for Senator Hatch, as two of my previous guests, Chief Judge Rader and Makan Delrahim. How did you end up working for him, and what was that experience like?
So I'm just going to note that unlike the two people you just mentioned, I've gone nowhere in life. I mean, you've got a judge, you've got a head of the antitrust division, he's in the news all the time, and then there's me. I'm an underachiever as a Hatch staffer. So I can't really tell you the full story the podcast for a number of reasons, but I'll tell you an abbreviated one of how I can't tell you the full story. So it's actually rather odd. I've never had a life plan. I'm not a good planner. So my career has largely been a series of happy accidents. So it's turned out well. I don't know, what is it, Microsoft? Somebody asked me to mention them, and I just said, don't do what I've done. Like the odds are it won't turn out. I don't know how I got so lucky. And so how did I wind up working for Senator Hatch? I worked on Senator Bennett's campaign. Senator Bennett was a former senator from Utah, yep, who was unseated by Senator Mike Lee, who's a wonderful guy, and I've known for a number of years. And after
a friend of your views.
He is not a friend of my views at all. He voted against the AIA. He is my second cousin, though. Yeah. So, yeah. And we worked together. We were young associates at Sidley and Austin.
Okay.
In like the 90s, I want to say. So he and I and his brother Tom worked together on a Supreme Court case involving the census that was kind of very relevant considering what's going on in elections today, but we won't get into that. So anyway, I've known him a long time and really like him, but he fundamentally disagrees with me.
I thought he did work on some patent reform stuff, subsequent bills to the AIA, but maybe that's old history. Anyways.
he's great. I would just say he... I wouldn't characterize him as sharing my view.
I was talking to patent policy issues, but anyways.
at least on patent policy. So back to how I got into the Hatch office. So after I worked on the Bennett campaign, I wound up in D.C. I was working for Senator Bennett. And for a number of reasons, I needed to leave that job and go into a new job. And so I just kind of randomly wound up as chief clerk of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which, you know, is like not even a step above receptionist, basically a year ago for.
So sounds very fancy.
It's a fancy title where I made in my first salary job on the Hill, I think I made $20,000 a year. But it was truly fascinating. There were some kind of historical reasons that they used to invite the chief clerk of the committee into the chief counsel's meeting. So all the Republican chief counsels, all the chief counsel for all the Republican members of judiciary would gather, I think, once a week, and they'd have a big strategy conversation. And I think that they'd always just had the chief clerk there to take notes, right? But it had gotten to the point where you didn't really take long, and there weren't a lot of go-dos, right? Everything had gone electronic. So I wound up being able to do that. So anyway, I worked for Senator Hatch for a year before law school, went to law school, did a clerkship, and tried big law for a while, and decided both the law firm and I kind of mutually decided that big law was not for me. And it was very much a mutual decision. They didn't quite kick me out, and I didn't quite jump out a window, but, you know, it was headed that direction. And by the way, great firm. It was me, not them, that whole thing. So so I interviewed. I actually had a job lined up at the FCC that got delayed, and I decided to interview with Senator Hatch's office up on the Hill, and it was actually Macon who hired me. Macon hired me as his replacement. He'd been promoted to chief counsel, and needed somebody to do antitrust work. And so he hired me into the antitrust law.
And did you have any views about patents? I'm guessing at that point you already knew, I guess, that Senator Hatch had some interest in intellectual property issues. But when you went to law school and through that, did that kind of...
Actually, not a whole lot. Like I said, I've never had a life plan, so I never planned on doing patent stuff. No, I had a very strong... So in the private sector, I did a lot of telecom internet law.
Yeah.
And I was in kind of an appellate and regulatory group. And I also had done a reasonable amount of antitrust work. And so those were my main interests when I went back to the hill. I really was kind of interested in antitrust and still find it interesting, although I'm way, way, way out of date in terms of antitrust law. But yeah, so I was actually the chief antitrust counsel on the committee and didn't start doing IP stuff for quite a long time working for Senator Hatch. And there were a couple of things that changed that. One was some departures of staff where he just needed a warm body to fill in, and I guess I was warm enough. And then the other was, through a kind of odd series of coincidence, I had the honor of clerking for Judge Prost. And after that, Senator Hatch, I think, incorrectly assumed I knew something about patent law. So I sort of got tasked with it. Hey, Dave, write me a patent reform bill. Hey, you know, we handle all these issues.
So you came back to work for him after you clerked?
Yeah, so yeah. That was like my third stint on the Hill was... I took a leave of absence from my job on the Hill, clerked for Judge Prost, which was wonderful. And I'd known her, actually.
On the Federal Circuit. Yeah.
On the Federal Circuit. Yeah. And I'd known her from the committee, right? Yeah. So when I was chief clerk, I believe she was chief counsel of the committee. So all there's this web of kind of former Hatch staffers out there. It was a fantastic clerkship. It was a little bit short because I was actually filling in for a clerk who'd made a 2-year commitment and left early. And again, see, yeah. I'm the warm body. It's just like, okay, we need somebody to fill in here for a few days. Let's grab Dave and he probably won't do too much damage. When I went back, I was stuck on the patent stuff. I also did copyright and still did telecom and antitrust. It's like the mafia. I keep trying to get out and the patent stuff keeps sucking me back in. So for, I don't know, going on 20 years now, I've been doing patent work.
You mentioned that Senator Hatch had a deep history with IP and patent issues. He had, alumni who went on to be
greatness
on the Federal Circuit and so forth. I mean, can you give us a sense? I mean, what is it like to be a staffer working on patent issues for him? Because, he had, I think maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but a mixed views on patent issues. How do you help him take positions on issues and so forth, or navigate patent issues? How does that work?
So I think I probably had a little bit different relationship with Senator Hatch than a lot of staffers. Looking back on it, I can't believe how much rope he gave me, honestly. It seems like, knowing myself, it seems like a bad idea, and I did some crazy, crazy things with that rope that all turned out pretty well, right? Like, yeah. I didn't get fired or anything. Mm-hmm. But with Senator Hatch... Senator Hatch was interesting. I guess I would characterize him as being, he was very pro-IP in general, but he also had this very pragmatic streak that you see in things like Hatch-Waxman, right? Like, so there's that sort of duality. His initial reaction, I think it's safe to say, was always going to be on the pro-IP side, thinking that rights holders should be protected, especially in copyright, where he had deep, deep relationships, and he himself was a songwriter and just really loved that community. But then there's also, he'd been a litigator, and he had this sort of pragmatic side as well. So when he heard, when he'd hear about, for example, litigation abuses by, plaintiffs in the patent world, it was just my interpretation, but I think he looked at that through like a litigator's lens and said, oh, that's terrible. And sometimes that would override, kind of his pro-patent instincts. And then some in other areas as well, like on Hatch-Waxman, I think he looked at the world and said, okay, we need to have brand name drugs out there and we need to have these companies doing the research, but we also need the cost savings that come with generics. How do you accomplish that? And, he and others came up with a solution that at least for what, 20, 25 years, worked really well. I'm not saying it doesn't work well now. I just don't do any of that work. So I don't know if it's still working. I assume it probably still does. You would know better than I.
I wouldn't say that, but. So you said he gave you a lot of rope. So does that mean kind of like where you kind of landed on issues, knowing his instincts, that's where you kind of ended up? Or is that?
Not necessarily. So I have kind of a weird view of government. Well, I'd say I have the appropriate and correct view of government. And I was deeply uncomfortable with making decisions because nobody elected me, right? I got hired, not elected. Like, the people of Utah, they never said, okay, we want Dave Jones making these decisions. So I actually had there were a couple of awkward times. Like, Senator Hatch wanted to introduce one of the early patent reform bills, and I refused to take it to the floor until he read the memo, like this detailed memo. And like, I actually made him initial each of the key paragraphs with the recommendations. Cause I was like, this shouldn't be my decision, boss. This should be your decision. And I'm here to help you make
and
that
decision.
And this is
the predecessor to AA?
Right? Yeah, this is, let me think. That was probably the Patent Reform Act of around 2006, which eventually evolved into the bill that became the AIA. So yeah, it was in that first kind of tranche of patent reform bills in the House and Senate that evolved into the AIA.
So your role is kind of providing that information, knowing where Senator Hatch was. Obviously, we've touched upon it many times, but it seems Senator Hatch had a very big network of alumni who ended up working on patent issues. How did that come into play? Because I'm sure they worked for all kinds of different organizations and had strong opinions and real-world experience to share. And here you are, kind of a relatively new guy joining in that role. How did that play, I guess, to you doing your work?
It's brutal, and it's all of the above. And I always tried not to take that stuff personally. But yeah, I mean, Senator Hatch had alumni all over the place on the IP issues. One of the ones I remember distinctly is he had a quite notorious, great guy, but a quite notorious former chief counsel who wound up working for Napster, right? Okay. So you wind up with those situations.
Not a copyright friendly.
Not place. At the time, at least a copyright friendly institution. Yes. You had all of that and intense pressures in multiple directions, and it is hard because you, as a staffer on the Hill, you just have to accept the fact that there are lots of people who have a stronger relationship with your own boss than you do and who are talking to him directly. And I guess my theory has always been, I don't know, and you've known me now for a few years, I think hopefully this will ring true to you. I just say whatever the heck is on my mind. Just give people my honest opinion about things. And then if they don't agree with me, I'm typically fine with that, right? So I think all of this stuff really should be a discussion rather than, like a one-size-fits-all sort of solution. So there were certainly some challenges there. But at the same time, I mean, my approach was always just to be very, very blunt with Senator Hatch about what I thought and what I thought the right policy was. And sometimes he agreed with me. Sometimes he thought I was crazy and threw me out of his office. No, he never threw me out of his office. But, sometimes he disagreed with me. And that was fine. He was the member, not me.
And is there anything that you learned about how some of these alumni were effective versus others that weren't as effective?
Oh, that's...
Was it always like, they should have just come talk to me? Or is it anything that you kind of...
It really could go either way. If you go straight to the boss, you're always taking a risk. And I won some of those battles and I lost some of those battles, right? So sometimes it was a great idea to go around me because, they knew I wouldn't recommend what they were asking for. So it was smart to go to Senator Hatch directly. Other times it backfired on him. I don't think there's any general rule. I guess, if I look at what correlated to success, I guess it's probably three qualities. I'd say tenacity. I'd say a bit of brashness, like the willingness just to march up and ask the question, sometimes in a kind of uncomfortable conversation. And I guess the third would be the strength of the personal relationship with Senator Hatch. He was a very, very loyal man. Yeah. So he, if one of his friends, like true friends, came to him and said, I need this, can you help me? He's just a very helpful guy. And not that he didn't want to help other people too. He just genuinely liked people. That was the other one other big challenge as a staffer with Senator Hatch. Is he always wanted to say yes to everybody, like almost no matter what the question was, because he genuinely loved people and he wanted to help them. And so part of the job of a staffer is saying, no, boss, you can't. Like, no, like stepping in, like, no, I don't think that's a great idea. But yeah, I'd say tenacity, strength of relationship, and then like a certain amount of brashness.
Is there anybody that you saw kind of overestimated the relationship they might have? And
oh, yeah. But I'm not going to talk about that. that would be mean. But yeah, I saw. Yeah, I mean, Senator Hatch, honestly, he was truly a lovely man. Like, I did things that, you know, maybe he should have fired me for, like crazy things. And he never...
Feel free to share. Yeah.
No, I mean, they wouldn't make any sense to listeners of this podcast because a lot of them had to do with Senate procedure. Yeah. But I can honestly say, I don't think he ever said a cross word to me. And I'm also just uncontrollable and kind of irrepressible. So I did things like once we were in his office and there's a group of us and he's playing us he had a demo of one of the songs he'd written that was kind of an R&B thing. So he turns his back and he's fiddling with the equalizer. So I start breakdancing behind his back, sort of like in a maybe not entirely respectful way. And he turns around and catches me doing it. And he just laughed. Yeah, he just smiled. I mean, he was really a delightful guy. I did see a couple of situations, though, where a staffer just pushed too hard. And Senator Hatch, in a couple of cases, was very direct and just said, listen, I don't care what you think anymore. You know, basically, decision's been made, move on, stop talking about this. And I was fortunate enough, I don't think I ever had that happen to me, but it can happen.
If you watch movies, you know, there's a portrayal of lobbyists, you know, they're whining and dining people on Capitol Hill. If you read, you know, the Washington Press, Politico, the effective lobbyists are those who have the closest relationship to the most powerful people in Congress. You know, the Jeff Miller and McCarthy, you know, he's constantly being written about, representing the big tech companies. But you work with another cynical portrayal is whoever can get more money, more donations to the members of Congress. But you work with both sides of the aisle. I've spoken to staffers on both sides of the aisle who have very positive things to say about you, even though they might not agree with you with all the issues. I mean, is lobbying on pan issues different from lobbying, let's say, for something much more high profile than that?
I think not really, actually. So my guess is that, and I don't have a full view into this, but my guess is that you've got kind of a similar spectrum of lobbyists on almost every issue, right? And that, you know, there is a lot of kind of access lobbying. That's basically you get a really strong relationship with a member of Congress, and then basically you're just selling your clients access to that member. When I was on the Hill, the lobbyists that I wanted to work with were the ones who A, told me the truth, and B, knew what they were talking about. Yeah. All right. That was basically it. I wasn't looking for anything beyond that. I just wanted to understand the issue, understand their position, and I wanted them not to lie to me. And you'd be amazed at how many people make the mistake of lying to staffers as if they're idiots. I mean, just like, and I've always think, I just from an ethical perspective, I don't like that. But B, I don't think it's productive. I don't think it's effective. So no, I don't think it's that different. And then I'm trying to think back on copyright issues. It was definitely that way. I mean, there were people that I relied on in the copyright world, and the ones I relied on were the people who knew what they were talking about and would not lie, right? And to their credit, I mean, there are a lot of people. I know what the kind of public view of lobbyists is, but kind of the interactions and sausage making on the Hill. Sometimes it really is that ugly. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm pretty cynical, and sometimes it is really bad. Sometimes there are some really bright points. I remember. I hope he doesn't mind my using his name here, but I remember Phil Johnson was the, at the time, I think the chief patent litigator at Johnson & Johnson. And, so I remember when we were working on the early patent reform bills, I called Phil in and said, Phil, I trust you to tell me the truth in private, right? Like, I want you to sit in this room. Nobody else has seen this bill right outside this office. I want you to read it, and then I'm going to come in and talk to you about it. And then Senator Hatch is going to come in and talk to you about it. right? That's what you get if you're a trusted advisor, right? So Phil, in that instance, got to provide feedback directly. My recollection is, at least, Senator Hatch at least came in briefly and talked to him about it. So he was able to talk directly to the sponsor of a bill about what he liked, what he didn't like, and had full access to information that other people didn't. And other people had that opportunity as well. I don't mean to say that was exclusive, but it's just an example of, I think, quite often the people that are most effective are the people who are honest and knowledgeable.
I want to kind of talk to you about how HTIA plays into that, because I never have thought about, you know, the reason you hire lobbyists is you don't have access to anybody in government and you want them to provide access. In HTIA, you know, each one of the member companies, each one of those CEOs can probably meet anybody they want in Washington, D.C. and talk to them about any issue they want. How does HTIA play? Why are they members of HTA? I guess that's the question.
It's a good question. I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I think HTIA is a weird organization in a few ways. So a lot of the membership organizations in DC, the primary point of contact at the member companies is going to be like somebody in government affairs. Yeah. HTIA is different in that for the most part, the board members are executives within their companies, right? So a number of people at the VP and kind of senior VP level are on the board. And they're, for the most part, they're not just figureheads. They actually engage directly. In fact, yesterday we had a...
And so and those the equivalent of what you think is a chief IP counsel?
Yeah. A VP for IP or a chief IP counsel. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Or in some cases, the chief patent counsel. But, you know, really senior people. So I guess one of the things that's kind of unique about HTIA is it's an entity that is basically controlled by the chief IP councils at these various companies, which is kind of a link that, you know, having been in-house, kind of can sometimes get left out, right? So the CEO has plenty, you know, they can pick up the phone and talk to whoever they want. The government affairs folks, that's their job, is talking to these people. They have all these relationships. Yeah. But if you're sitting in, you know, somewhere in California as the chief IP counsel, there are not a lot of great entrees into the policy world. And, you know, at least from my perspective, one of my goals is to make sure that HTIA is that it's truly member driven and that these chief IP councils are able to, you know, really actively participate. And I tell you, they really actively participate. In fact, the reason we had to schedule the last interview time, we were doing a brief on kind of fairly short notice. And I got a note from the outside counsel. I told the outside counsel before we started, I said, listen, my members can be a little bit of a handful. They're very active commenters. Just be forewarned, basically. They're very nice, but yeah, they have views, and they're not shy about expressing them. And I got this very nice note back from the outside counsel that said something like, and it was a head of an appellate practice at a major firm, said that he'd never seen such an engaged client or gotten so many comments. It's like, yeah, it's substantive comments. I mean, something along those lines, which in a way is nice. I'm sure it ran him way over budget, but it was kind of a kind compliment.
Those chief IP counsel, they can go to their government affairs folks or they can go through you. I mean, is it a way for them, I don't know if it's...
to go around their GR people?
Or just they have pent-up policy, things they want to get done, so they're not always kind of...
not really. No, I don't... I mean, I don't know. You'd have to ask that. Maybe some of them do that, but I don't think so. I mean, the general practice with HTIA is we generally have two points of contact at most of these companies, right? Okay. So their GR person will be involved, but the board member will be the chief IP counsel.
I see. Or someone, okay.
Right. So
you're all working together.
Really is kind of a collaborative thing. And my member companies are great. Honestly, like there are times when, you know, I'll go to one of my member companies, GR folks, and say, like, I'm the wrong person to make this argument. Can you guys go in? Or, you know, I might go to Micron and say, you have a really solid relationship with the Idaho senators, which I don't, because I grew up near Idaho, but I don't know these folks. So, could you go and talk to them about this? And members are usually very, very generous in that way with their resources.
During the last interview, we talked about maybe some of the difference between your companies, but what actually binds them together? I mean, if you go on the HTA website, it says something dramatic increase in abusive patent litigation. And then, I mean, the great thing about your organization, all the members, is public information about who they are. But it's not all the big tech companies that you think of. It's a sampling. It's a variety of both hardware and software and online platforms. What binds them together?
So that's also an interesting question. In part, it's history, right? So some form of this organization has been around in you know, with different names for a very long time. So the kind of heart of the group was involved in something called CPF, which was Coalition for Patent Fairness. Am I getting that right? I don't know. We were members.
Sounds familiar.
I should know that. But in the kind of AIA days, these folks were kind of a tight-knit group that, you know, that was run kind of the same way, right? It was less formal. It was more of a coalition style, didn't have an executive director, I don't think. But they were quite effective. And a lot of the folks in the group have known each other since then and have known me since then, which is kind of interesting. So some of my board members have known me upwards of 15 years, which in some ways is very nice and liberating because they knew exactly who they were hiring when they hired me. So there are no surprises at all. They knew who they were hiring. And I can honestly say that they're great, right? Like I've known a lot of them for a very long time. I trust all of them. I really genuinely like them. So I think actually that kind of camaraderie is part of what keeps HCIA together. In terms of what else binds them together, I'd say it's, you know, HCIA members tend to be the ones in the industry that care more about patent issues, honestly, and have larger portfolios, I guess, right? So, you know, we've got Samsung, well, the U.S. subsidiary of Samsung, but Samsung's the biggest patent owner in the world. And I think, I don't know, you read the webpage, so correct me if I'm getting the statistics wrong, but I think my members have been granted that something in excess of around 350,000 patents. We're about to update those numbers because
they're definitely some of the biggest patent filers.
So they care, and I mean, think about you do a lot of patent prosecution work, right? Yeah. Think about the resources it takes to amass 350,000 patents.
That's an impressive number.
Yeah, it's huge, right? So it just indicates these companies actually really care about the patent system on both sides, right? They're frequent defendants, but they're also some of the largest patent owners. And so, you know, a lot of it is just the kind of the strength of interest in the patent issues.
One thing that I think, obviously, you joined, you left Senator Hatch's office and you joined Microsoft back in 2007. Before AIA, maybe the beginning of the patent troll narrative. But if you look at a company, and I don't know how much you could talk about it, but if you look at a company like Microsoft, their evolution about how they approach patents has changed. You know, Bill Gates, he personally funded intellectual ventures, from what I understand. People change, personnel change, their views, their situation change. And you were at Microsoft for 10 years. I mean, do you think companies like that are sort of sometimes too short-sighted, or do these companies take the long view? And not just Microsoft, but in general, companies that kind of navigate patent issues. Is it just about like, well, I have these 100 different patent trolls coming after me. Let's just pass a law to ban them and then figure out what's next?
So there's an interesting dichotomy within the companies, right? So I don't think there's any single answer to that because there is really a dichotomy within the companies. If you're talking the patent litigators, their time horizon is like 1 to 2 years, right? What do I need today to win the cases in front of me now? And that's their focus. If you're talking to people in the patent group, right? If you're talking to the chief IP kind of counsel or officer, they have a much longer view, right? So they're looking at 20 years out on patents and they're looking at a lot longer out on copyright. So it really depends on the part of the company that you're talking to. And having been internal at Microsoft, having been in-house, I think taught me that those conversations are really hard sometimes because you have sometimes you just have diametrically opposing interests within the company. And, you know, I have to say, I really benefited, you know, while I was there, I think there were, so I was on the patent group side within Microsoft. And while I was there, there were two wonderful kind of people that sequentially kind of ran IP litigation, Andy Colbert and Isabel Fu, who were just great, right? And you know, we disagreed all the time, frequently disagreed. And but,
sorry, just so I understand, I guess the litigation group was separate from the patent group?
Yeah, at Microsoft, at least, the lines of authority, right? The reporting lines actually didn't meet till the general counsel.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So if you couldn't resolve it at my level, then it went to kind of like a deputy general counsel level. If they couldn't resolve an issue, then it went to the general counsel, which, you know, your goal is never to have that happen. You never want to have a fight in front of the GC. So I have to say, I had wonderful colleagues, but it did sensitize me to the fact that there are just very different interests within the company. And sometimes I think what is perceived as like an evolution in company views in part is a shift within the company as to like who's doing the talking and who's more engaged in the policy.
Yeah.
Right. So it, you know, it doesn't, I wouldn't say that Microsoft, certainly its views have evolved. I don't want to give that short shrift, but I think they've probably evolved less than you might think looking from the outside. And that part of it is, like, you know, shifting roles inside the company. Several years ago, started before I departed Microsoft, but, you know, they downsized their patent group a little bit, and just, you know, it was clear the company was taking a little bit less focus. I mean, they're still a major applicant. They still care about patents. And that's created a bit of an impression of a change, but I think it's, honestly, it might be less than you'd imagine from the outside. My guess is if I went back and worked there today, I'd see the same kind of internal tensions that were there. And they're there at other companies too, just to be clear. It's just a natural tension.
Companies end up relying on their patent portfolios in ways they didn't think they would need to.
Now you're trying to get me into dangerous water here, Eli.
I mean, do you think companies, I guess, in your members or, you know, similar situated companies take that into effect, that, you know, maybe one day they're going to sell off of a 5,000 patent portfolio and try to quote unquote patent troll, you know?
You know what happens, right? Yeah. Like and honestly, there are sometimes very different views on that practice. My own view is that I think at one time or another, most of my companies have done that, right? It's like, it's not uncommon. And B, I feel pretty strongly that if you're on the corporate side, I mean, you have a duty to your shareholders. And if you have an asset that's worth a lot and you're not able to do anything about it, I don't care what the asset is. It could be a subsidiary. It could be a product line. It could be a patent portfolio. You have an obligation to your shareholders to try to maximize their value. And if at that point you let kind of your patent ideology get in the way of increasing shareholder value, I think you're doing the shareholders a disservice. So I guess, in my mind, you know, maybe I wish it happened a little bit less, but I also think it's the right thing to do in a lot of ways.
Sorry, and maybe that was a caricature example. Let me give another example. And this is just nothing. I'm not thinking of anything specific, but let's say, you know, you're one of these big tech companies. You're on top of the world. You don't really need to rely on the patents because you have billions of dollars coming in always. And then you invest in research and development. You apply for patents, relying on thinking, you know, I'm spending a lot of money, I'll be able to rely on them. And then a malicious competitor comes in and just steals your IP, your trade secrets. And then that's when you want to enforce patents. This is just an example.
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
and that's also not uncommon, right? Like, my members have sued other companies. In fact, I've got multiple members that have sued each other, which I think not while I've been there, but, you know, it's a little uncomfortable. I was on a panel once, I think, with David Simon from Salesforce, and I just got done saying publicly how well kind of Salesforce and Microsoft got along. He's like, yeah, that's why you sued us last week or something, right? And I was like, whoops, I guess I missed that complaint. So you're always thinking in that direction, honestly. I think the one thing that to me is pretty clear in the tech industry is that you can't perpetuate kind of a monopoly position through patents. It just doesn't work, right? If it did work, then IBM would be Microsoft and Google, right? IBM would have been the leader in kind of operating systems and office software, and they would have dominated the internet, right? And heck, maybe they'd be every one of my companies, right? Because I'm sure they would have developed an interest in e-commerce. They could be Amazon. They could be Oracle. Like any of these folks. They certainly could be Dell, right? I mean, they actually manufactured a lot of this stuff. So I think the thing that's always, or at least what I've observed, is that and I think this is more or less how most tech companies look at it these days. Patents are helpful. You know, and I actually think most of my members think patents, at least at the international level, kind of the fundamental level, drive innovation, right? So patents are important. They're not going to save your market position, right? They just aren't. So you're faced with a situation where you're investing heavily in a wasting asset, and you're always going to have the question of how best do I use that asset today? Is it licensing it out? Is it asserting against my direct competitors? Is it selling off the patents to somebody else? Is it coming up with some, you know, interesting type of licensing arrangement that benefits my customers? I mean, there's always a goal, or there should be at least in every IP group, a goal in the back of their mind, like, how do I use this wasting asset and not just let it sit there?
Yeah, and I guess I'm more interested from the perspective of taking positions on patent policy issues, right? There's the position they could take that could immediately benefit your company, let's say, sure, versus saying, you know, we need these startups because we rely on their innovation and we want these startups to be incentivized to say, you know, we're going to invest and so forth. How do you balance those things? How do you look outside your company to say, actually, the health of the patent system is important for innovation as a whole, even besides the immediate patent issues we might be facing? Or is it very hard to
do? It's hard to do, and you'd have to have a crystal ball to do it super well, yeah, right? So sometimes, like, the smartest people in the world aren't going to get it right all the time. You know, that's something, honestly, I guess on that issue, I view myself very much the way I did when I was working for Center Hatch. I mean, that's for my member companies to individually and collectively figure out, right? I can advise them, but that's a really hard thing to do, is to strike that appropriate balance. I guess the other thing that I'd react to in your question a little bit, and this is a little bit off topic, yeah, but at least in tech, I know there's this whole kind of narrative out there about the death of the patent system and Alice destroyed everything and the PTAB is, you know, death squads, blah, blah, blah. That just hasn't been the experience in the tech industry. And I'm not speaking here just from the kind of large tech perspective. There have been a number of economic studies that say that, like, small software companies, small tech companies had an increased chance of getting venture capital post-Alice than pre-Alice, and that their overall valuation went up post-Alice relative to pre-Alice.
I think some people would disagree with those studies, but
some people might. But I mean, you can, like, and this is another thing that, like, you know, you can disagree with data all you want, but unless you show me how the data are wrong, then there's not much of a conversation. I think it's always
above the top of my head. I think a lot of other things happened post Alice that kind of made valuations of startups go up.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, there are also always outside factors, but they usually try to do some sort of difference. Yeah. Get a, like, assessment, so where you take out the overall economic trends. But yeah, I mean,
they're very talented study.
I don't know how economists work, but they seem like really smart people.
After our last interview, kind of more details about what happened in D.C., it seemed like, tell me if you agree, but it's in some ways, Senator Tillis and Senator Coons were kind of setting the narrative on patent policy issues in D.C. Senator Leahy decided he wanted to kind of come back for 2 years as the subcommittee chair, and that seemed to shift completely the discussion in D.C., at least from my perspective. Did you notice a similar dynamic? And is it really that simple that Senator Leahy just decided to take over that subcommittee chair? And
so I'm not going to purport to know what was in Senator Leahy's mind. I don't know. In some ways, yes, it was that simple, right? Like, I don't think that's the full story, but on the Hill, whoever holds the gavel as the chairman of a full committee or subcommittee sets the agenda. And in some ways, it has a lot of power in setting the narrative. So, yeah, I mean, it really does matter who holds the gavel. And I think the presumptive chairman of the IP subcommittee next year is going to have a very different kind of outlook and tone than agenda than Senator Leahy. And I think you're going to see the same thing in the House, right? So yeah, personalities matter. The views of the chairman always matter. So I think that is a big piece of what happened. I guess the other thing I'd say is that, at least from my perspective, some of the early ambitions on patents kind of ran into reality. And staff over time, I think, acquired, and this is not a criticism of staff, right? Everybody learns through experience. And I live in a glass house. I did a lot of stupid things on the Hill, so I'm no position to criticize anyone. But I think over time, like staff, you know, like initially the staff, and this is just my interpretation, a lot of staffers thought, oh yeah, everybody tells us 101's a big problem, let's just fix it. So, and after hours and hours and hours of conversation, everybody in the room realizes this is not a simple problem, right? This is not something where a Band-Aid is going to fix it. This is a real discussion. And so I think that, that also kind of changed things over time as this kind of reality sink in that, like, it's not clear there's one right answer it's not just as simple as like
guessing. You're thinking specifically of Section 101, kind of, is that?
I'm thinking about all of it, honestly. Like I think the same thing of the PTAB, right? Like I think in the early days of the PTAB, there were probably, and maybe my members will kill me for saying this, I think there are probably some instances where there's a little bit of overreach and that people are a little overly enthusiastic or had a mindset that maybe wasn't entirely balanced. And that's not to criticize anyone. It's just to say that, you set up a new organization, there's going to be hiccups. I also think that some of the concerns that people cite about the PTAB are just totally unfounded. So I think it's on both sides. I think these are genuinely complicated issues. And I guess the one wish I would have for patent policy is that we move to something closer to a kind of fact-based, evidence-based policy-making model, I'll give credit to all the offices on the Hill, but in particular the Tillis and Leahy offices. I think they did that, right? I don't know how much insight you had into the 101 process that I can't talk about because I'm sworn to secrecy and all that. But there was a lot of homework on that, Eli. I mean, there's a lot of homework, a lot of footnotes, a lot of...
A lot of conversations with David Jones.
Well, you can't really avoid conversations with me. That's one of my pet issues. So.
The PTAB, I guess, is more, there haven't been any legislative changes, but the administration changed. And I think at least there was some hope that I heard from those working in the outgoing Trump administration that, Senator Coons is going to play a big role. He's from Delaware with Senator Biden. You read that, the Biden administration isn't going to be as big tech friendly as the Obama administration was. And then, one of the first major decisions that they made is the COVID IP waiver, which I guess even a lot of people who think that patent rights needs to be restrained to them, but it was kind of something very different.
A little surprising.
Yeah. Were you surprised in the direction that the Biden administration took with that or just in terms of patent policy in general?
I wasn't surprised about the direction. I guess I was on the COVID waiver. I was surprised at how explicit and how strong they went in that direction. So the direction didn't surprise me, but like how quickly they got there and where they went surprised me a little. Because back when I was working in the Senate, that would have been unthinkable, right? To imagine the U.S. would go. Go to the international community and say, let's just have a waiver here. I don't mean to make light of that at all, but like it would not have happened.
I mean, for many years, U.S. was the beacon of IP rights. U.S. was out there defending IP rights and making them stronger.
I'd argue they still are, but go ahead.
but it was a very interesting switch in dynamics. These European countries, these, socialist countries were saying, no, this is too crazy. You cannot take away IP rights from private companies. But
yeah, no, it was interesting. I guess the other thing I'd note there is that it actually fits in completely with your narrative, although you seem to kind of suggest it didn't.
Like, I don't have a narrative.
Well, I'm sorry. the narrative of your question, not like your personal narrative, right? I think the Biden administration is less tech-friendly, right? And the COVID waiver has nothing to do with tech. We didn't ask for that. We don't benefit from it. I don't think we care about it. I don't know. I'll ask my members next time I talk to them. But, like, you know, that's not something that we're actively engaged on. I think the thing that may have surprised a lot of folks is that my perception is the Biden administration takes very seriously some of the folks in the kind of access to medicines, access to healthcare kind of community. And there's some very persuasive, very knowledgeable, very passionate, patients groups, doctors groups. The ACLU has dipped in and out. And my perception, at least, is that is largely what kind of drove that decision and that process. And in that sense, it is almost exactly what you would have predicted right beforehand, is that, yeah, it's less tech friendly. You know, they're not focused on the, you know, it's not like there's been a resurgence of the patent troll narrative coming out of the Biden administration. They're doing things, I think, more in the healthcare space, and particularly in the kind of pharmaceutical biotech space.
I see. You've talked about how, you know, it's always a good bet to say that nothing will happen in Congress. But, you know, I've seen actually the Congress being very effective, Senator Leahy and Senator Tillis, over the last 2 years in their letter writing campaign. They write a letter to the PAN office, the PAN office reacts. They write a letter to Chief Justice Roberts, he reacts. I mean, I don't know, maybe I've just not been following things closely, but what's going on? Is that always standard that the other branch is kind of...
it's always different. There are always kind of strange dynamics between the branches of government on these things. I think, I mean, it's kind of my comment about, like, you always bet on nothing happening, I think probably came out of that. Was it that IP watchdog panel that you're at? it's true. Like, legislation is really, really hard, especially in the Senate. There's always been that dynamic. In fact, if you go back, I used to have a chart that tracked, like, all the major issues that were addressed in the early patent reform bills, like pre-AIA, and how many of those were resolved by the courts, yeah. Right? So you saw the same dynamic back then where, like, it wasn't letters, it was legislation in that case, where, people would, members of Congress would introduce legislation indicating they thought there was a problem here, 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 and here. And then 2 years later, you look back and the courts, you know, either the Federal Circuit or the Supreme Court had resolved a whole bunch of those issues. Yeah. And so I think that dynamic is always in play. My belief is that, most of the action over the next 2 to 4 years is going to be in the administration and mostly at the PTO and in the courts, right? That, I think those are the places where changes are kind of more readily available. So, yeah, and I think, I think Senators Tillis and Leahy and their staffers, Brad and Molly, I'll just give them a shout out, have done a fantastic job in getting the other branches of government to focus on issues that they care about. I think it's been a really savvy strategy.
What do you think is the dynamic? Why is a USPTO director... I understand why they're listening, but why are they responsive?
All sorts of reasons. Let's start with kind of the most cynical, crass reason, yeah. Right? Like, Senator Leahy's the chair, unless I've confused myself, which I do occasionally. Senator Leahy's like an appropriator, right? He's chairman of the Appropriations Committee. You want money in the federal government, you know, it's probably best not to upset Senator Leahy. But honestly, like, no agency wants to upset any member of Congress, right? So it's not just that. It's not just the money thing. I mean, members of Congress can make life quite unpleasant for a patent director, right? They can call oversight hearings and have summon the director up to the Hill and pelt him or her with really uncomfortable questions and yell at them. I've seen some, I haven't seen it happen in a while, but I remember... someone I knew well being called, who was a, I won't say too much about this, but who was the head of a agency, not the PTO, called in front of Congress and, like, you know, wound up crying. I mean, it was just brutal. People were screaming, you know. And so you have strong incentives.
Like, with the letters, the weird thing is, which I don't get, is I could probably find two senators to disagree with this, right? So you have these two senators writing a letter on something, and there's probably two senators who disagree with whatever this one letter is, right?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. And let me also give you the optimistic version, is that branches of government should be working together, and the PTO and the courts are being collaborative with Congress, which...
Or they just happen to have similar views, right?
So there's a cynical explanation, but I prefer the optimistic explanation. And in this case, I actually think it's true, right? Like part of this is just persuasion. Yes, you might be able to find two senators who disagree. The interesting thing to me is, like, I mean, I don't know. Let me ask you this. How many senators out of the 100 do you think really care about patents? Or really are going to focus, not at a high level. Like, you talk to every one of them at a town hall or something, they're going to say, yeah, patents are great and innovation is great. But who are really, really willing to get in and assign staff to do the work and really focus?
Three.
Yeah, right. So I think you've just answered your own question in a way. You say, well, two of them sent a letter on one side, and you said, well, you could find two others that disagree. Yeah, you could. Yeah. But if we're right that there are only three people, okay, I think that's underestimating it a little bit. But you'd be one short. Well, and then the response would be, you know, like...
Last time I interviewed you, you said two, so I...
oh, so you upped me? I remember that. What I said was that for most... And I stand by this. For most members of Congress... You know, patents aren't going to be on their top 10 priorities or something, right? Like, unless you're the chairman of the subcommittee or the ranking member or you know, sometimes the chairman or ranking member of the full committee, it's just not going to be, I mean, you're not going to be staffed to do it, right? You're not going to have someone like Brad or Molly who's like deep into the details who can actually write that letter. So it's actually, it's kind of hard in some ways, which incidentally makes it hard on both sides, right? Because when you lack that expertise in the office, you're much more susceptible to like things like narratives, right? You're more likely to depart from the evidence-based policymaking that I love and hold dear.
So even though from the outside it might just seem like just a letter, it's actually much more. It takes a lot of work to get that done.
It takes a lot of work, and I can't speak like to those examples because I'm not on the Hill, but. At least when I was on the Hill, it's not just writing a letter, right? Like, or at least that's not the way I would have done it. And I'm knowing Brad and Molly reasonably well, I they're very savvy, and I don't think that's the way they've done it. I would be amazed if at least some of those letters weren't preceded by conversations with the PTO.
Okay,
right?
See.
So, yeah. I mean, keep in mind, A, that the letters are just kind of the external evidence that something's going on, and quite often it's the tip of the iceberg, right? Right. It's just what the public sees. And I'm not saying there's anything kind of secretive or malign here, but there is always going to be a conversation between kind of the chairman and ranking member with the agency that's under their jurisdiction. And it doesn't matter if that's, you know, the antitrust division when Macon was running it or the PTO now that the director Vidal is running that. Yeah, keep in mind those letters really are kind of the tip of the iceberg, and you don't even see all the letters, I assume. At least in my day, there were two kinds of letters. There were public letters, there were private letters, right? Public letters, you do a press release and it winds up on your webpage. The private letters, the public does never see, and you don't see the phone calls, you don't see a lot of this stuff. So, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's natural. That's the way it should work. I'm a fan of transparency, but you know, those conversations need to happen. I guess I've probably gone on too long about that, but I just say, yeah, it's not just the letters.
I think discuss things at a general level, but I do want to ask you specific. I think you've expressed that you didn't think it was correct that Judge Albright was getting all these patent cases. Is that a fair thing to say?
Not exactly. Oh. Right. So I should probably, so I'll start off by saying I don't know Judge Albright, but I've been at conferences with him, and he seems like a really likable, really smart guy, right? So, like, I have nothing at all against Judge Albright. Institutionally, you know, for me, it's not about any one judge, right? Institutionally, I over a period of time. And this, honestly, this in part has its roots in the kind of very unhappy period of my life where I was doing like product liability litigation, just really ugly stuff. I really don't think it's good for the civil justice system or criminal justice system for that matter, just kind of the judiciary in general, to have the ability for the plaintiffs to unilaterally choose the adjudicator that are going to be before, no matter who that is and no matter which side, right? So I don't think plaintiffs should be able to do it. I don't think defendants should be able to do it. Yeah. I actually believe in, structured, somewhat rigid venue rules. I actually believe that, you should be in a convenient forum. And I also really, really believe in random assignment, right? Because that would go for, honestly, any judicial or quasi-judicial body. So yeah, I mean, for me, it's not about Judge Albright. I have nothing against Judge Albright. It's more the kind of institutional, and which honestly has nothing, like Judge Albright didn't create the division. He didn't make the rules. this just doesn't have to do with him. It's a systemic problem. And you look, and we may focus on the Waco division, the Western District of Texas, because we're patent people. Yeah. But if you were involved in the, some of the amphetamine litigation, product liability litigation, back in the day, you might be focused on, Cook County, Illinois, or somewhere else. Or if you're in the kind of Suzuki rollover cases that I was involved in a couple of decades ago, it was other jurisdictions that were the magnet jurisdictions. So I view that very much as kind of an institutional rather than an individual problem.
So does it equally bother you how many cases end up in Delaware and California? As somebody who was born in middle America or somewhere.
I was actually born, maybe I'm a coastal elite. I was born in LA.
Oh, okay.
I was actually born
makes
at,
a lot of sense,
at UCLA. No, because there's random assignment, right? Like, I guess my rule of thumb would be, I would like to see a world in which anytime a complaint's filed, there's a pool of, at least three judges, and you get random assignment among those three judges with all the usual caveats, like related cases. Yeah, for efficiency's sake, it makes sense. Right. So I'm not saying that like you have to have this kind of crazy rigid system. I guess what's bothered me, and this long predates Judge Albright, right? Remember, I came up in the Eastern District of Texas days where people are, screaming about that. And I had the same view then. I remember telling the litigators at Microsoft, because I actually clerked on the Fifth Circuit, right? Yeah. So which includes, obviously, both the Eastern and Western District of Texas. I remember once telling one of my colleagues, these judges are not bad. I clerk down there. I can tell you which districts you really don't want to be in. And it's not this one. Right. So for me, it's just very much a kind of systemic issue.
So, would you be in favor of a system where they got randomly assigned across the country, and putting aside, obviously, there's all these precedent about venue and blah, 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 $1 trillion companies can't afford to travel to Texas and all that. But putting all that aside,
with the recent drop in the stock market, are there any $1 trillion? I haven't been paying attention, but
would you support a system where cases got not where companies didn't just have to be assigned throughout the country, not just in Delaware and California?
No, that would be madness. Actually, no. It should be a convenient forum, right? And that includes the plaintiff's interests. Like Really, and again, this is, I should make this very, very clear. This is my personal kind of deeply held view, as maybe
but
you can tell.
But isn't that form shopping? You said that you don't like the idea. If a company, these are public statistics, right? If you end up in California, you're likely to lose that patent litigation, and it's likely to take forever. And so this is friendly for a defendant in a patent case. Is that not fair of that to patent owners?
Well, I'm just to be clear, this is Dave Jones, not HTIA, but under my mental model of how all this should work, you wouldn't have any of that, right? You could still, as a plaintiff, choose to go to the Waco division, right? Just the Waco division would include three judges, and you'd have random assignment among the three judges. I just think you need I don't think there actually has to be much. I will say, at this point in my life, I've known quite a few judges, and I think without exception, they are they're truly remarkable people. I mean, very honest, very hardworking, a lot smarter than me, great judgment, right? Like, you don't become an Article III judge by being an idiot. Well, maybe there are exceptions. I haven't met them yet, right? So I'm not saying there has to be much there. I think there just needs to be like the tiniest buffer. So maybe the best way to answer that is saying what I find concerning is mostly judge shopping as opposed to venue shopping. I don't love venue shopping. Let me be clear about that. I don't think they're the same kind of risks, the same perception problems to venue shopping.
So if Waker Division had three judges, let's like promote those magistrate judges to district court judges.
And randomly assign it. Sure. I mean, like, you know, and you may interview me next year and I will have changed my mind because it turned out to be a bad idea. But yeah, no, I mean, honestly, that's all I'm saying. Okay. I just think they're like, you know, and again, this is not just a patent issue. Yeah. This is happening a lot in other areas of litigation with all sorts of plaintiffs who are saying, there's a single judge division here. If I file in that courthouse or if I choose that courthouse from the pull down venue when I file electronically, I know I get that specific judge. Right. I just think, like, if you went into any, like, first grade class in America and said, hey, kids, I got this great idea. You know, whenever there's a dispute between two of you, if your last name's, you know, is A through K, you get to unilaterally pick the individual adjudicator among your friends who's going to adjudicate this. They would say, that's nuts. That's unfair. And like, so what I'm arguing for is basically like kindergarten, first grade, fairness.
And I mean, there are towns with one judge, right?
There are.
Yeah.
There are. And, yeah. And that would be slightly less convenient for plaintiffs. But again, I like, and should just emphasize over and over, this is not speaking on behalf of ACI, this is my own personal view. No, I think you need like three judges, right? So like it might mean the plaintiff has to drive, I don't know, 50 miles or 100 miles, which, you know, honestly, I take your point about $1 trillion companies, and none of my companies, at least while I'm at HCIA, are going to claim poverty because they're well-resourced. But I think you also have to keep in mind that, and you said there are like defendant-friendly venues. I mean, the vast majority of patent cases end in victory for the defendant. That's just a fact. I think probably even in the Western District of Texas, yeah. I don't think it's even 50-50, right? So, you know, and there are a few different ways to look at that. I guess, you know, from a defendant's perspective, something like 3/4 of the time, you've got your attorneys being hauled across the country and you're going to pay $2 to $5 million to defend a case that quite often is going to turn out to be meritless, or at least the infringement, you know, is not demonstrated. So most of the time, these cases aren't successful. And I would argue that much of the time, not always, but much of the time, they're not even well-founded. So I think there are interests on both sides, but I actually, and maybe I'm a little too plaintiff-friendly there, I actually believe in local convenience. So yeah, you want to put three judges in the Western District of Texas, you know, that'd be, at this point, that'd be fine by me. But what I would advise is to do it in every single judge district around the country, because this isn't just a patent issue.
Yeah. So then I guess a question about that specific order that was handed out by Judge Gonzalez in the Western District of Texas, were randomly reassigned only the cases filed in the Waco division. Would you have changed that aspect of order to at least randomly assign all patent cases in the Western District of Texas? From a fairness perspective,
I'm on this one. I'm not a litigator, and I no longer live in Texas, so I'm not going to second guess anything down there, because I'd be speaking from a position of ignorance, honestly. I guess what I'd say, I just reiterate, like I think that order is a step in the right direction, but again, I don't see this as being about any particular judge. Yeah. I see it as being about a system that allows one side to unilaterally choose the adjudicator, which I just think, like, again, you ask any first grader, they're going to tell you that seems unfair. And it also seems like a recipe for at least harming the perception of the neutrality of the judiciary, which I care. I mean, I did a couple of clerkships. I respect the judiciary immensely. And I also don't want to see that happen.
Yeah. But I think the broader debate really is, maybe that aspect isn't good, but the alternative might be even worse for this specific set of cases. And
explain that to me. Like, what's the argument there?
Well, the alternative is if Judge Albright doesn't handle these cases, they have no chances of seeing trial within the next 10 years.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I mean, I've known more than one Texas judge, and I like in any Texas courtroom, I'm maybe not any, but in most of the courtrooms in Texas, I don't think you've got any problem. They don't seem to like summary judgment a whole lot.
Oh, I see. If within Western District of Texas, you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, and leave the cases in Texas. My members may disagree, but leave the cases in Texas. I just want random assignment. And that's kind of how it turned out, right? Like, I can't remember exactly what the order said, but it basically creates a pool of, 10 or 12 judges? I think...
And I guess we'll see. Maybe other judges will adopt his rules and so forth, so it will be a positive development. So we'll see.
Yeah. I honestly don't think plaintiffs... still seem to be filing there, at least some. Maybe initially that was by accident because they didn't know about the order. But now at this point, it can't be by, assuming they have decent counsel, they know exactly what's going on. They're still filing. I guess the other thing I'll say is having done this a long time, I think people often overestimate the impact of any one small change. And that's a welcome change. Don't get me wrong. And again, I would like to see it systemically across all areas of law and across the entire country. But do I think that it's like a game changer? Maybe you disagree here. I know there's at the conference we were at recently, there's a lot of shouting about this, but I don't think it's a game changer.
I don't think so, because somebody else shared this theory that other judges in the Western District of Texas will follow Judge Albright's lead. And I don't know if that person's being optimistic or what, but it's something, I guess, that I find...
I actually think it's pretty likely, right? He seems, like I said, he seems very likable and very smart. Yeah. So I don't know why judges wouldn't learn from him.
Him and Judge Gonzalez obviously had some issues, but I think...
I know nothing about that. I can't comment. I don't think I've ever talked to either of them, right? I may have been in the same room or at the same conference, but I just don't know either of them really.
I mean, one thing that I have to credit Judge Albright is he does go to all these conferences and does explain his position, opens up himself to question, which I think more judges should do in general. But
I agree. And like I said, immensely likable man from what I could tell from, I was just an audience member. I wasn't, chatting with him, but he seemed knowledgeable and very nice.
So I want to kind of end by going back to where we started about, you mentioned you met with a member of Congress to talk about patent issues. I know you know all the staffers really well. Can you give us a little bit of insight? How do you think about, there's a lot of turnover among staffers, but how do you build those relationships? How do you, can you give us a little bit of insight? Let's say you hear Joe from the USPTO is now a staffer for Senator Coons. What do you do next?
You mean like Joe Blow or Joe Mattal? Or
Joe
like, it depends on the Joe.
John Smith.
John Smith. I honestly don't know. I can tell you that I'm pretty sure that in the first meeting almost every staffer has with me, I do something that makes them think I'm completely insane, which is probably why I'm memorable. And then at some point
do you mind sharing your tricks of a trait? Do you you reach out and say, hey, we should meet up or?
I don't have a bag of tricks. anyone who's willing to talk to me about patent policy, I go and talk to them. I usually tell people, too much about what I think and do it too candidly. Yeah. And then we just take it from there. And, here's my one tip for anybody. I genuinely enjoy my job and I genuinely like the staffers on the Hill, at least the ones that I interact with regularly. And just if you approach the world that way, I genuinely like them. I try to tell them the truth. When they ask me for advice, I try to give them candid advice. I obviously have certain obligations to my members where, the things I can't tell them. But when that's the case, I just say, I can't talk about that or I can't advise you on that. And I think over time, people get past my obvious weirdness and for whatever reason, they seem to like me okay. I'm not saying they like me any better than anyone else, but at least I get in the door and I've really enjoyed it, honestly.
Can you give me a sense of a tempo, in terms of, I'm going to go talk to X about this issue right now, or I'm not going to go talk to this issue, or I'm going to go talk to this member. How do you think? There's so many
I told you, I'm not a planner. I got no plan. I just like, you know, whoever seems interested in talking to me, I'll go talk to them and tell them what I think and try to do my best to represent the views of my member companies. You know, there's some, I guess there, that's an oversimplification. I mean, the, you know, normally you would start off with the key staffers, right? Who are the dedicated IP staffers for the chairman and ranking member of the subcommittee and full committee, right? And honestly, that's most of the place I have my relationships, because there's people who are willing to talk to me about PEN. So I know this is going to surprise you a lot, but for your average, you know, what, 22-year-old staffer, who quite often not an attorney on the Hill, that their interest in talking to me about patent policy is pretty limited, right? I might get 5 minutes of mind share before their eyes glaze over, roll back in their head, and they fall asleep on me. So I mean, it really is. A lot of it is just, you know, figure out who's willing to talk to you, who's actually interested. I tell you, it's wonderful running across people like the ones that are up there now, who are actually passionate about it, right? Yeah. The key staffers up there on both sides of the Hill are very experienced, have strong views, they're passionate about it, and that just makes for interesting conversations. So that's kind of where I focus a lot of my time. I'll also say, and I think I said this in our previous interview, like, simplifying things down into kind of bumper stickers and really connecting with like people at the member level or the kind of non-specialist staffer level is not my forte. Like, I'm just not great at that. I only have about three topics I can talk about. It like in all of life, right? Maybe four. I can talk about my dogs and machine tools, patent policy, and maybe politics, right? Like, I'm not a good dinner guest. I'm not particularly likable. That's just not that's not really what I do. Luckily, I've got fantastic lobbyists who are good at that. they can handle that piece of it. You know, because at the end of the day, I'm the executive director, so I'm kind of lobbying is not, I would say, my principal function. I actually have to run the organization. We do a lot of things as you know, from our email exchanges, I'm pulling my hair out frequently on amicus briefs or comments to the PTO or other stuff. At least for me, I generally focus on really the people who let me in the door and have a conversation. Yeah. It's not really more complicated than that.
We mentioned, you know, there's not that many of members of Congress who are, for who patent issue is a priority. But is there anything like you hear about this congressman making a random comment about patent trolls or something like that, and we're like, he could be a real ally for this, or he's really not that important? Or is it kind of that predictable? You work with certain staffers on these issues. Down the line, if you need to convince other members of Congress, you kind of rely on your lobbying relationships.
It's unpredictable. I mean, my advice to anybody would be, you know, treat everyone as a friend and treat everybody like they're important. For both like ethical reasons and practical reasons, right? The ethical is obvious. The practical is you never know
To enjoy it as well, right?
What's that?
and to enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, have real conversations. I mean, you just can't, you know, like take Joe Mittal, for example, right? So when I first knew, and I'll say the first time I really got to know Joe a little bit, I was stuck at a metro station and I'd left my wallet somewhere.
And Joe Mittal, so people might know, he helped pass the AIA. I guess he worked for Jeff Sessions at the time.
He worked for, I think, John Kyle, but I could be wrong about that. But anyway, I think he may have worked for both. But you know, so he lent me some money so I could get home one night, just because I'm you know, not a planner and not very good at apparently keeping my wallet on me. You know, but at the time, he wasn't really involved in patent stuff. He was doing judges. He was doing a bunch of other, as I recall, like kind of tour film type stuff. Yeah, immigration, right? So like, you know, I think at the time, nobody would have said, that guy is going to, like, you know, like I wouldn't have thought that. Like, that guy's going to turn out to be the acting director of the PTO and key to enactment of the AIA. You just don't know. So yeah, I mean, I think from a practical view, like, no member of Congress is unimportant, and no staffer is unimportant. And the other thing that I just having been a staffer that I think people should keep in mind is they're actually real people. you can fall into this thing as they're tools that you use as a lobby. They're real people. I think just, approaching the world that way seems to work for me, at least until I get fired by HTIA, and then we'll have a different interview at some point, maybe. But that'd be my advice, I guess.
So we'll lead on that semi-optimistic.
And I should, because I mentioned Brad and Molly several times. Yeah. I should say Jamie and John, like, this is on the House side.
Yep. So Brad Watts, who's been on the Clause 8, he works for Senator
on detail to Senator Leahy. John, I think, is on detail to the House Republicans. And Jamie is a former staffer for Senator Coons, who I've known for a long time and is currently working for the Democrats on the House side. So four wonderful staff. And I don't want to leave. I'm not going to list other staffers because I'll leave somebody off, but they're also wonderful staffers in the full committee chairman's office and ranking member's office. So it's, I don't know, I think it's a good group up there.
Even a better note to end this on. So thank you so much, Dave, for doing this. We appreciate your time on Clause 8.
Not at all. It's great to see you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.